Welcome to the ABCDA podcast. This is your host, Ruchira Tripathi, and you're listening to the Voice of Industry. Outer space, cosmos, antariksh, luarankasa, whatever you call it in your language, space has gripped our imagination for centuries. Moon landing is the biggest event that has happened in our lifetime, and we've tried to relive that excitement through numerous movies made on space. The Martian, Interstellar, Gravity, October Sky, so on and so forth. And I'm sure that in your local languages, you would have other movies as well. After a period of lull, the space industry is having a resurgence. According to the Space Foundation report, the space economy was worth about $500 million in 2021 and is set to become a $1 trillion industry in the next few decades. It's not only one of the fastest growing industries, but it's also a key enabler of growth and efficiency in other industries. Today, I'm in conversation with a very dynamic Zahira Lee, and we will be talking about all things space. Zahir is the CEO at Positon, managing partner at New Space Finance, and professor of practice for space business leadership and policy at the Thunderbird School of Management. Please note that the views expressed on the podcast are that of my guest and are not reflective of their organization. Welcome to the show, Zahir.
Ruchira, thank you so much. I'm really pleased to be here and have the opportunity to speak to you and your audience. Very excited to share a little bit about me and how I got into space, and also what is going on in a time that is truly, truly remarkable to be alive. It's the stuff is happening now that people are going to be telling their grandkids about, and it's amazing to be part of it.
Wonderful. So let's start right there. I want to start with your journey. You mentioned earlier in one of the conversations that we were having that you don't have a typical background of a space geek. How did you end up in this industry? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks. I've always loved space, but I'm not an astronomer. And there's this perception that you have to either be a rocket scientist or an astronomer to be part of the space community and the space economy. And that's not true. In fact, I spent a lot of my early career running away from space. As an experimental physicist, I studied primarily instrumentation. So these are, and devices. So I'm what you would call a device physicist. I even have 10,000 hours in the fabrication lab, making microchips and micro devices to sense everything from acceleration to light to pressure, etc. And I spent a lot of my career, the first half of it really, working on national security type issues and technologies for the United States of America. But there is that tug in every technical person's heart to go at some point and work for NASA or an organization like that. And when the opportunity came about, I took it, and I ended up working on a suborbital observatory looking at space, doing science, but not actively engaging with space assets, at least not initially. And then my career took me into different projects and programs. And even before, when I was working on national security issues, we would use space assets. And so what was funny is that the thing that I had at one point tried to run away from came to take over my life. Even though in many ways I was always an outsider to space, not being an astronomer or a rocket scientist. But that's really what's going on, is that today, when you look around the world and hear about the space economy, it's not driven by rocket scientists or astronomers. It's driven by everybody else. and what everybody else wants to do, everybody else's aspirations and inspiration, and the opportunity to be and do more as a species for humanity than perhaps most of us in my generation had thought possible 25, 30 years ago. So it's a tremendously exciting time. We're turning science fiction into science reality every day.
It's interesting that you say that it's not driven by rocket scientists. I'm curious to know a little bit more on that. I mean, we keep hearing this term new space economy. What is it actually, and how is it different from the old space or the traditional economy? Because as you kind of slightly reference to it, something has changed, but what exactly has changed? Could you share a bit more?
Absolutely. There's one fundamental change that was achieved by SpaceX, and it does have to do with rockets. But it's not necessarily the rocket science part of it, meaning it's not about the propulsion, it's not about the rocket design. What SpaceX did was they reduced the cost of launch by a factor of 10. Whereas prior to 2014 to 2017, the cost of launch was between $10,000 to $70,000 per kilogram to orbit, meaning that is the dollar amount you have to spend per kilogram to get to orbit. That is everything included. They've taken that and they've decimated it in the literal sense of the word, meaning to reduce it to 10% of its value, right? They have cut it by a factor of 10, and that has created a renaissance in interest and capability of what we can do in space, because it's so much cheaper to put interesting stuff up there. When it cost that much, when it costed so much money to get even a kilogram to orbit, that kilogram had to be over-engineered to an extreme amount, had to be perfect, had to last 20 years, 25 years, because it was going to cost so much to get it up there. Now, you have companies planning obsolescence of orbital assets for between 3 and 4 years. SpaceX, OneWeb, etc. The mega constellations. They want to replace those satellites with the newest, hottest technology in 3 to 4 years. Whereas every NASA mission that is ever launched, including James Webb, has launched, by the time it launched, the technology was already obsolete that was in that system because of the lead time, because of the testing, everything it took. So this has completely changed the game. It's like if tomorrow the price of petrol was cut by a factor of 10, everybody would be driving everywhere. Everybody would be shipping everything everywhere without a care in the world. They wouldn't even think about the cost of transport. We're not quite there that people don't have to think about the cost of transport to space, but it's completely changed the game so that a high school team that's in the US, that's 9th through 12th, they can raise funds by doing odd jobs and fundraisers, car washes, what have you, build a CubeSat and get it to orbit as 17-year-olds. What a fascinating modern age we live in. That was not something that I had dreamed of at 17 because of that cost of mass to orbit. Now, when that happens, when that reduction happens, everything people have been dreaming about, if only I could get this up to orbit to do this, now suddenly is, when can I get it up to orbit? Let's go now. And what it also does is it changes the fundamental mentality in the way you design missions and think about how you go to space. So a lot of this is really, really nascent. because it's right now at the hybrid of old legacy technologies and some new designs, some new methodologies. Now, people will say, well, how did SpaceX do this? It must be the reusability of the rocket. That's not true. They realized this cost reduction by completely changing the way a rocket was developed, tested, deployed, and manufactured. They leveraged learnings over the last 30 plus years from Silicon Valley. And the way that the new space companies do things is fundamentally different than the way the old space companies, the legacy players, the bigs, as we call them in the US, Lockheed, Boeing, Honeywell, Raytheon, all those big, primarily defense contractors. The way they do things is with four different outcomes. But in the commercial world, it's okay if we break a few things. It's okay if we blow up a few rockets, because we're going to move fast enough and we're going to create enough value that we can accept that risk. That is very different than the way government and national security operate. So by changing the management practice, they were able to reduce this cost. And other innovations have been critical in that. Additive manufacturing, or 3D printing as many people know it. Additive manufacturing is a more general term. And nowadays, a lot of people prefer to use it. That's been a game changer. Robotics and artificial intelligence, being more precise than a human and being able to do things in a more hazardous environment than a human without tiring. So that's been critical in this whole discussion. And other things that happened adjacent to this. The fact that we have graphic processing units and a complete gluttony, we're swimming in processing power and storage, means that you can do so much more in simulation than you could 20 or 30 years ago. So that by the time you cut metal, as we say, and start actually getting to testing hardware, you've come 90% or more of the way in design. Whereas previously, you would stop analysis anywhere between 50 to 70% complete, and you had a massive testing program ahead of you to get to the 100%. All of that's gone because of these adjacencies that SpaceX and other new space companies have leveraged to become part of their process, part of who they are. And these technologies plus the management philosophies have really enabled this renaissance. And what's super exciting is that really since 2010 to now, it's not that long. Even 15 years ago, what you would find is that none of this had been realized. So what people need to realize is they think, the space economy, it's been booming and we keep hearing about it, so it must be stable now. No, we are not at the exponential part of the curve. We're very much still at the low end of it. The most exciting stuff is yet to come. And you're seeing some of that in what's happening with satellites and the applications thereof in terms of looking at the Earth in different ways and deriving information and a lot of other things. But the fundamental enabling factor has been the reduction in cost of launch, which led to this explosion of innovation and usage of space as a place to do things.
Right. And some would argue that, you know, there's no dearth of problems to be solved on Earth, with climate change being the most compelling one. Why should we be spending time and energy and resources on space? I mean, when we should be working on challenges that are more immediate and closer to home. So is there something that you would like to say on that?
Absolutely, definitely. One of the things that is unfortunately poorly understood is how much of modern life is dependent on space and innovations that are on Earth because of space. If you like your cell phone, if you like your laptop, thank the space program. The laptop was first invented. In fact, I teach in the Thunderbird School of Global Management's EMGM, Executive Master of Global Management, Space Leadership, Business Policy. One of the other professors who teaches in that, Glenn Edens, invented the laptop. And he did so for use by astronauts so that they didn't have to deal with console computers that were antiquated, etc. Now Glenn is a true Silicon Valley original. People like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates used to ask him for advice. So it's quite interesting to teach alongside such an accomplished gentleman. But he's seen a lot of this grow, and he's a deep tech computer engineer, not a space economy person at all. But he has been very clear, like, IT, technology, industries leverage tremendous amount of work that came out of the space economy. Now, that's just IT. If you want to talk about energy, if you want to talk about things like water, if you resource management, there's no environment humans have ever been that is harsher and harder to survive in than the vacuum of space. There is no power there. Solar panels were driven in development due to the space program's desire to have more power on satellites. And in space, there are very limited options to produce power. You're pretty much either doing photovoltaics, solar panels, you've got a nuclear device of some sort, or you're doing some sort of plasma fusion. That's about it. Or you've taken a bunch of batteries with you, which are heavy, very heavy, which is actually why lithium ion batteries were invented. Again, thank you to the space program for the fact that you have lithium ion batteries and made all your electronics smaller. So, and then that's just the space program and the technology developed. On the other side, if you've ever been lost and whipped out your phone to figure out where you are, say thank you to the space program. That's based on GPS. GPS changed the world. It's produced multiple times the world's economic output per year in value. All the applications, all the geofencing, how much of our economy today relies upon the ability to know where you are and know what time it is very precisely. That is what GPS provides. And as we move forward, fusion power may first be fielded in space before it's ever realistically fielded on Earth. And that technology will feed back to Earth and help you know, save the planet. You mentioned global warming. Global warming has been confirmed to be anthropogenic, meaning caused by humans, by space-borne assets. They are best measurement tools of this. And we use it to track methane. We use it to catch bad actors that are creating more pollution than they've been authorized to. We use it to optimize. We use satellite data to optimize crop yields and help feed people. We use it to predict floods and evacuate people. I'm working with a company now, Precursor, that has shown the ability to predict the ionosphere. That's critical for communications around the world. But the other thing that I'm extremely excited about is that they have, for the first time in history, in my opinion, a credible way of high confidence earthquake prediction. as a San Francisco native who lived through the 1989 earthquake, saw the pavement outside my house look like a sine wave that I could have surfed down with an amplitude of 4 feet. Had my father stuck in an office building in San Francisco, where he said that the building moved and the other buildings moved so wildly, they looked like reeds moving against each other in a windstorm. And the Golden Gate, the Bay Bridge broke. It was amazing. And just weeks ago, Turkey. If they had had one day of notification, how many lives could have been saved? So that's all due to space data and space-borne assets. Space is the space economy and space technologies applied to problems on Earth will save Earth. Aeroponics, hydroponics, agroponics, vertical farming, all of that was developed for the space economy, brought into Earth. And now we are actively researching advanced pharmaceuticals. Cancer may finally be within our control thanks to pharmaceutical compounds that can only be manufactured in low gravity. When you try to grow an organ on Earth, they end up flat as a pancake. Artificial organs have shown to basically be impossible to grow on Earth. The gravity is a problem. You can't have a pancake-shaped liver. However, in microgravity on orbit, we've shown that we can create these things. It is extremely exciting. And they can do it from your own stem cells, so you don't spend a lifetime on extremely harsh drugs to prevent your body from rejecting a donor transplant.
Yeah.
These are things that'll change people's lives, save millions of lives, improve hundreds of millions of lives. And they already have. The fact that people can at a street market take payment on a cell phone is directly due to the space economy. And so when you start understanding what's going on, you quickly realize space is already integral to your life. It's not will it be, it's not when it is now, today, integral to your life. You don't, right, just don't realize it necessarily.
Right.
And what's going to be amazing is that because of these enabling factors, this reduction in launch and the new designs and ideas we can now test, we're going to find ways to do things that are even more exotic, like go mine resources in the asteroid belt, or, you know, perhaps closer first on the moon, and bring those resources to Earth, preventing the need to do horrible strip mining and other types of mining on Earth.
Actually, I wanted to ask more about that. You know, what are some practical business cases and realistic profit models for the new space economy? We can see it in the launch business, you talked about that, or the satellite business, but where else can money be made in space realistically? I know we talk about mining the asteroids and moon, but I suppose we are still a little bit, you know, there's still time till we get there. But I mean, if you were to think about where do we make money, what would those areas be?
It really depends on the time scale. In the more immediate time scale, launch is almost becoming a commodity the way rail is on Earth, right? You know how much it costs to move something, mm-hmm, point A to point B. It's a commodity. Kilograms and time and currency. Simple math. Launch is going in that direction. What's really exciting is not satellites just in terms of making satellites, but what you do with them. The data from different imaging companies, Maxar, for example, has been absolutely at the quality only a few years ago that only governments have. And in some cases, although the militaries won't admit it, it may be better. And we've seen the effect of this in the Ukraine crisis. The completely despicable invasion of Ukraine by you know, despotic Russia has demonstrated so much of what new space can do with imaging and communications. To go alongside that imaging, you have Starlink enabling communications where they have been blacked out through any other means, through destruction of infrastructure, thereby enabling many, many things. And people focus on, okay, well, the Ukrainian military is using this to find the enemy or to communicate. Yes, that's true. At the same time, the humanitarian efforts that are ongoing, people in country providing medicine, food, and other support to Ukrainians, all people involved in the conflict, and of course refugees, they are reliant on the new space technologies, functional capabilities to provide them communication, to provide them the ability to do what they're doing for humanitarian sake. So you have that one example of communications through new space. Another one is in the usage of this data. Yes, it can be used in a military theater, but we're also doing things like understanding to the single plant level what is going on in a field, and then enabling delivery of exactly the right amount of nutrient or water to maximize crop yield. We're also able to do things like monitor for in certain areas of Africa that are not really controlled by any nation. We are able to tell people to move and avoid warlords. We're able to use Earth observation data to help predict the price of oil, wood, and many other commodities. So a lot of trading houses are very interested in different students who develop models in their graduate studies around certain economic factors that can leverage space data to predict. And another one is different types of imaging that are enabling a complete digital twin of the Earth in three dimensions to 10 centimeter resolution. This is absolutely remarkable. And that's being fully digitized so that we can start simulating things about the Earth and running a million tests in a month, whereas at a very low cost, because it's all in simulation, whereas before we would have run one test in a month at extreme cost. So there are a lot of business models around clever ways to use data coming back from space about the Earth. Now, moving forward, you're going to see a break. You're going to see a continued development in space for space, a better propulsion system, a better telemetry system, a better laser communication system. But on the other hand, in my opinion, the real fun is what are the applications to all the other industries? How is food distribution going to leverage this? How are sporting events going to leverage this? There's a host of things, and it's really about clever people, letting their imagination kind of go wild and saying, not can we do it, but this is what I want to do. How do I leverage all these now new tools and data that are available to me to make that happen?
So what I'm hearing, Zahir, is that there's a lot of work that's going on in the new space economy, which is space for Earth kind of applications, not so much as space for space. Do you think that's going to happen later, or it's happening simultaneously, or what's going on over there?
It's simultaneous. A lot of what happens is that the space for space is very deep tech, and the people who understand it and are going to leverage it are primarily already in the space economy. So it's not pulling more people in. And the general people in the general economy may not quite understand all of that. Yeah. Why? What is the difference between a hydrazine pure engine versus a hybrid versus a pure whatever based rocket engine? It's a rocket engine. Who cares? That may be the attitude of some people. Now, inside the space economy, there's very fundamental things that means. Different types of fuels lead to more or less buildup in parts of the rocket engine itself, meaning that you may get better performance out of fuel A, but you can reuse the rocket 100 times if you use fuel B. So people may prefer fuel B, right? That's a very much inside of the space economy discussion. However, you have companies like Interstellar Labs, out of France, led by Barbara Belvisi, who are creating pods where they initially designed and ultimately intended for growing crops in space, but are now being bought by desert and other extreme weather nations around the world. They're very popular in the Middle East. Scandinavia is interested as well, because they let them grow crops that they might not otherwise be able to grow. So there's a tremendous amount of ways of thinking about this. Really, what happens is, the other part of that is that the space for space is going to grow, but space for everything else is going to grow faster as people mm-hmm. start to understand, be more educated, and let their imaginations take over about how to leverage space, how to use space for these other industries. So not only is the whole aggregate will grow, but even as the space for space is growing, the space for everything else is going to grow much faster and, frankly, likely be much more exciting.
Right. So I guess that's where the rest of us, you know, who are not typically rocket scientists or space scientists, that's where we fit in. That's what you're saying, if I understand correctly. And that's how we can be part of the space economy.
That is one of the ways to become part of the space economy without necessarily being somebody like me who has a background in experimental physics, or mm-hmm. my friends who are astronomers, or other friends who are whatever flavor of engineer. There are fundamentally two ways to become part of the space economy, is to figure out how to use space or to figure out how to do stuff in space.
Okay.
And what's really exciting is that at NASA, for example, every type of technical background is relevant. But what people don't always understand is that we have one of the most critical jobs in NASA is life support and life support equipment maintenance and creation. And the people there have to know how to sew. Stitching is critical. It's absolutely critical to the right material, mated to the right material with the right type of stitch. Such a simple thing that somebody would think, my grandmother stitches. Well, you know, these guys stitch really, really well. And people's lives depend on those stitches. And that's now being understood better and becoming part of the greater context. In general, what you see in new space is they have pulled a lot from old space on the technical talent side, but on the non-technical, human resources, you know, recruiting, getting the right people in, that's a people skill. That's not something that the space recruiters haven't existed very long. So they're pulling in people from every other field to jump in there. So if you're a recruiter, well, space company may need your help. But that extends to every level of, you know, business development, but, you know, sales and marketing, outside sales, everything from being able to call 50 companies and have a conversation about what their technical needs are and how it fits their product, your product. That's not a space specific skill. It helps if you have some engineering background, but a lot of people can learn it. And so they're pulling those people in from other industries. Finance, of course, everything from business analyst, financial analyst, you know, accounting, you know, CPAs, certified professional accountants, as they're called in the US, to the folks who do kind of the high level finance, the CFO types who are looking at every metric about how what the business health is. Those are critical roles, and management at different levels, really at every level, and leadership. So there's a lot of management roles that you need to know enough to be dangerous, as the old phrase goes, but you don't have to necessarily be a deep engineer. And what has happened is that there's a resistance in a lot of companies say, oh, well, we want somebody who has experience in space or technology or whatever. But that's breaking down because it has to. Not only because there aren't enough people for all the roles that need to be filled, but also because they're realizing that the non-tangible, the intangible skills, the transferable skills often outweigh the domain expertise. And you see that in some companies that are succeeding versus some that are failing.
So what are these, you know, transferable skills that you're talking about? Are there certain competencies that are valued in the new space economy, you know, more than some of the other ones? Could you share a bit of that?
Absolutely. Peter Beck, CEO of Rocket Lab, when I spoke to him, I guess it's almost a year ago now, we chatted for a different program. And I asked him, what does it take to get a job at Rocket Lab? And Peter is a really interesting guy because he does not have any degree at all. And yet he's the CEO of a multi-billion dollar rocket company. How did that happen? He is insatiably curious and willing to do what it takes to figure stuff out and build stuff. He started his career as a machinist and a hobby rocket builder. And so he's a hero to many of us who have built hobby rockets because he's the guy that made it and made a company of it, and an international billion-dollar company at that. And what he said to me was passion. Passion for space and what it can do for humanity is really critical. But that also extends to what you're using it for, the outcomes, because the thing is, space is really hard. And people who are now like me, who've kind of been in and around space for a while, we've persevered through a lot of years where nobody cared. So we people in the industry resonate with people who are motivated, whether it's by space itself or to use space for something that's relevant for humanity, to really be passionate about it and do something with it. The people skills are critical, and the ability to communicate and really be part of and possibly lead a great team. Those are lessons that have been learned, as they say, in blood throughout aerospace, where things broke down, leadership broke down, or teamwork broke down. And so, and space is a strange community, because even while people compete, the story of the X Prize, I believe it was, where Mastin, the day before they won it, they had a major failure. Their competitors spent the night with them, rebuilding and helping them get this, only to watch them win. I can't think of another industry that such a thing would happen. But that's Wow. That's the community of space. So people look for an emotional fit more than you might expect, actually, from a very technical and logical industry, and other transferable skills in terms of the ability to handle complex, long-term tasks, goals, and projects. Space requires a lot of grit. People spend 15 years. I know people, by the time James Webb launched, I knew people who had been working on it for 30 years.
Wow, almost their whole career.
Exactly. But that's the grit that space takes. So people look for that. People look for people who they know won't give up and have the ability to have a lot of failures and a lot of disappointment, but persevere through that and then, you know, land a rover on Mars, or, you know, put something in the orbit of Saturn or something. Those things take a lot of time. So people appreciate and value people who have that ability. But new space is fun because it also values tremendously a lot of the modern tech mentality of let's get it done, let's get to good enough and test and fly and see how it goes. So it's interesting because there's an impatience in the industry now that was not there 10 years ago. But for many of us, we think it's a very healthy impatience because it's time to go.
Right. We are almost out of time, Zaheer. I have a second last question before we kind of wrap up. What's next in space for humanity? What more needs to happen in your view?
What's next in space is for us to really start leveraging it for Earth in the most immediate ways possible. And some of that is going to mean not only the Earth observation and the usage of satellite data, but including countries all over the world to find uses for themselves. Because there's this sense that it's US and a couple of European countries in China, and that's it. And India, of course. But that's not true anymore. Africa is actually pioneering developing world usage and involvement in space. And a lot of other developing countries should take note from what African nations are doing, leveraging it as a tool to build capacity in their country, a reason to have better degrees, better jobs, and using it as a reason to have modernization and to create different tech centers within their countries. And so what is really interesting is, like the internet, as people in countries that are not the US or China or France or Germany want to look at what to do in space, what's next really is people there thinking about how can we use this locally, the way people have thought about how can we use the internet locally in India, Southeast Asia, Africa, etc. There are use cases there that simply don't exist in Europe or the US or what have you, because it just doesn't make sense. So there's a lot of discovery to happen there. The other two things a little farther out are in-space manufacturing that I already talked about a little bit earlier, things like pharmaceuticals and organs, also certain materials. That's going to be very interesting as well. And then we look farther out as we develop the concepts for space research capture, which really will revolutionize humanity, because it'll mean that we don't have to worry about how much cobalt there is in the world anymore, or lithium. We can just go get more, and that'll change things dramatically.
Right. Any final takeaways for our listeners? If there were just three things you want them to remember from this conversation, what would those be?
Number one, the new space economy is for everyone. And if you think if you can't imagine yourself in it, then you need to work on your imagination and really try and think, not how could I be in space, but how is space part of me? And how can I use all these capabilities to do interesting things in my sphere of capability? The second thing that I would have people take away is that we've only just begun. So if you're not sure how this works out for you, and you're uncomfortable with it, that's fine. But you should prepare your children and your grandchildren, because they're not going to have a choice. So this is where we're headed. I don't like to think of space as the final frontier. I like to think of it as the infinite frontier, because there is basically just an infinity of things to do and ways to create value out there. And third is that even though there's a clear advantage and capability in some countries for space, space is the province of humanity, not for any nation. Neil Armstrong didn't say this is one small step for an American. He said this is one small step for a man, a giant leap for mankind. That is all. And we need to remember that yes, there's a lot of geopolitics and all that exists around this. But at the end of the day, those things come and go, and you only have to read a history book to realize how ephemeral borders and nations really are in the grand scheme of things. Half the nations in the world today didn't exist 60 years ago. But what will exist indefinitely is our ability to collaborate and create great things. And space is an opportunity to get that right as humanity takes its next steps out into the cosmos. It's an opportunity to be together rather than to be apart in the place where we go find our future.
Thank you so much, Zahir. I mean, thanks for the information, the insights, and for such a wonderful conversation. It's been such a pleasure to have this chat with you, and lovely to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you all. Be well. And eventually, look forward to seeing you in orbit.